A landmark climate conference in Paris will go on as scheduled, yet in the shadow of extra security concerns. Good morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9, and thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. The show is always live at 9, and now subscribe to the daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. And just ahead, why those landmark talks in Paris on climate take on a new tenor in the wake of the terror attacks in the French capital. You can get on the line now with your thoughts and questions at 549-2937. Also this morning, our First Coast Connect book club looks at the great movies of 1939. Yeah, the movies. Some of them started as books. Our book club blogger, Stacy Goldring, and our own in-house movie lover, David Luckin. We'll talk about that then later. Local charities use the power of social media to harness a new movement, hashtag Giving Tuesday. All of that ahead this morning. But first this hour, a potentially historic UN summit on climate change later this month in Paris, expected to draw President Obama and other world leaders, will be scaled back due to security concerns following the terror attacks Friday that left 129 people dead across the French capital. The French Prime Minister is reportedly telling local radio Monday morning in Paris that the conference will be reduced to just the negotiations between the country's representatives, saying that most concerts and festivities and a large planned march through the streets of Paris will most likely be canceled. So what can be expected out of this conference with its ambitious goals to reduce carbon emissions around the world? Josh Gellers is an assistant professor at UNF and a research fellow at the Earth System Governance Project, the largest network of social scientists working on governments and global environmental change issues. And he joins us now with a look ahead to the Paris talks. Josh, a pleasure.
Oh, thank you very much, Melissa, for having me.
And here's our question to callers. What are your thoughts and questions about the climate talks that will go on as scheduled in Paris next month? Give us a call right now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online to wjctnews.org/firstcoastconnect. Email and tweet the show. And so we're learning this morning that, yes, the talks are still on, but in a much reduced fashion, Josh. And that's not surprising.
No, not at all. The security concerns obviously have now overwhelmed Paris, the authorities there. And so the concerns that remain involve how can we continue to have the Paris talks in light of the terrorist attacks that occurred in not only Paris, but also Beirut and Egypt, and also show that they are not afraid to continue to work on international cooperation on climate change issues.
You're involved with the Global Network for the Study of Human Rights and the Environment. That's the world's largest network of scholars and lawyers that work on issues at the intersection of the environment and human rights. They're issuing a draft declaration on human rights and climate change. It's intended to promote a discussion about human rights issues at these negotiations, drawing attention to the ways in which the status quo affects the global climate and how that also impacts human rights. How will this discussion even get traction, given the way that these attacks have overshadowed the talks? Or do you see these all intersecting and actually being quite relevant?
Well, I think that they do have a lot of traction. They certainly are and continue to be relevant. And this isn't something that is advanced just by the Global Network for Human Rights and the Environment, but also the Pope recently made comments before the United Nations indicating that climate change is an issue that involves all of humanity and invokes human rights concerns because it threatens all of humanity. And so despite the events that occurred in Paris, I fully expect that human rights will be part of the conversation. The question is how much, and will that discussion find its way into the ultimate treaty that people are hopeful will be reached upon the conclusion of the conference?
The number to join us, 549-2937. A set of principles will be drafted in advance of these talks. What will those principles lay out?
So the principles actually are currently available in draft form online at the website, which is gnhre.org. And it provides basically a holistic approach to understanding the intersection between human rights and climate change. And this means everything from understanding how humans are part of a broader ecological system to people having rights to know what's going on with respect to the environment, protecting the fundamental rights of vulnerable populations as it impacts their health, life, housing, right to movement. All of these things are animated by climate change concerns. And so the declaration is an effort to move the discussion forward and to get this on the docket and the agenda.
How can you give us an example of that? If you can, paint a picture of what you're talking about.
So I have the declaration right here, and I'll just read some of the earlier principles that are declared. For example, human rights and a profound commitment to climate justice are interdependent and indivisible. All human beings have the right to a secure, healthy, and ecologically sound Earth system and to fairness, equity, and justice in the provision of climate resilience, adaptation, and mitigation. And the thing that's interesting about this kind of an approach is it helps to elevate the conversation about climate change by drawing upon human rights principles. And this is not something that's altogether that new, but we have, for example, the area that I study, environmental rights. There are about 100 constitutions throughout the world that have some environmental rights in one form or another in their constitution. So we are trying to elevate the discussion of climate change, but frame it in a way that it respects and understands the human rights implications.
Is this too ambitious a goal, given that as the world's leading nations prepare to meet in Paris, nearly 200 countries, deep divisions between these nations over how to get to the goal of reducing global temperatures from rising more than 2 degrees Celsius, 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit, above pre-industrial levels? There are deep divisions among the nations as to how to even get to that target, let alone having the human rights discussion that you're talking about.
That's absolutely true. However, we've seen signs of progress. The United States has agreed to terms with China to move forward on sort of a bilateral cooperation. China itself has moved in the direction of addressing climate change, not only because the people there are sort of compelling the government to address the issue of pollution.
And they're participating in the talks.
They are as well. So that's correct. But they've also established their own cap and trade system. So they're using market mechanisms to address the climate change. And you're absolutely right that the tipping point, so to speak, that people talk about is this 2 degrees Celsius increase that countries have to agree upon measures that will limit the rise in temperature to that level or lower. And right now, the what are called the INDCs, the Intended Nationally Determined Contributions, feature submissions from 161 countries, which account for nearly 90% of global emissions. But the projected, the math doesn't work out right now. Right now, it's focused on about 2.7 degrees Celsius by 2100, which will not get us beyond the point that we need, which is that 2 degree threshold.
I'm going to quote now from the St. Petersburg-based website PolitiFact, a fact-checking organization. They reported recently that the influx of Syrian refugees exacerbated existing problems like unemployment, corruption, and brewing discontent with the regime of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, which failed to respond to the situation. In 2011, the unrest reached a boiling point and erupted into the Syrian uprising. Actually, what they were talking about was the Fertile Crescent's worst drought on record, causing extensive crop failure, skyrocketing food prices, and a mass migration of farming families to urban centers. Once the war had begun, all sorts of pre-existing actors took advantage of the situation to pursue their goals. The collapse of Syria providing fertile ground for ISIS. This is not to say, of course, that climate change caused the rise of ISIS. However, PolitiFact does draw a line between the drought in the region and the Syrian refugee crisis. Do you see a correlation?
Absolutely. I think most of the research in this area on environmental security suggests, in a very modest way, I think, that climate change relates to conflict in a way. It's not the primary driver of all conflicts throughout the world by any stretch of the imagination, but it does have an aggravating effect. And even our own Pentagon has called climate change a threat multiplier in the context of international security issues.
At the same time, the Democratic candidates for president are being ridiculed for making that distinction, making that connection in particular. presidential candidate Bernie Sanders in the Democratic debate Saturday night is being ridiculed throughout the internet for saying he still believes climate change is America's greatest national security threat. What would you say to those who find his statements to be preposterous? They see terrorism as America's greatest national security threat.
Well, it's not inaccurate that climate change poses a security concern for the United States and other countries throughout the world. The issue is really to what degree, how is this going to impact American security? And we've seen from the statement that you read about from PolitiFact that there is a demonstrable connection between the Syrian refugee crisis and climate change. And so again, we have to think in sort of broader terms as far as the relationship between climate and security, not whether terrorism is the primary concern or climate change is the primary concern. They are interrelated. And I think that's the thing we need to mention.
And as we discuss the Paris climate talks scheduled for December, we want your calls, 549-2937. Rachel's on the line from Brooklyn, New York. We have national reach this morning. Hello, Rachel. Good morning.
Good morning. Good morning, Dr. Gellers. How are you?
I'm great. Thanks.
Great. I just had a question this morning. I hope you can help me to understand. Given the relationship between what a healthy ecological system is and population health, I'm just wondering if you can help me better understand that relationship and how it may at all be a factor in the next presidential election.
Sure. Well, thanks, Rachel, for your question. The area that I study, environmental rights, is fundamentally focused on this relationship between the health of our ecological system, human health, the environment, human rights. They're all interrelated. And so, you know, the thing that I draw upon for my research is statements made by the Supreme Court justices of India, who said it, maybe in a better way that I could ever have said it myself, which is the fundamental right to life presupposes that you have a clean environment. If you don't, you won't be able to enjoy the right to life. So we've seen this happen in our own history. The United States has the most robust system of environmental laws out of any country in the world, and that's a result of acknowledging the relationship between human health, ecological health, and the role that the federal government has to play in making sure that there are enough regulations in place to provide that kind of a clean environment for everyone.
You run the Enviro Rights Map. That's a digital platform looking at the state of environmental rights in countries around the world.
Correct, yes.
Basically. What would you say to listeners right now listening to this discussion that don't accept the science behind climate change? And they look at the Paris climate talks and basically just think it's a waste of time. They don't believe climate change is a problem.
Well, even people on all aspects of the political spectrum at this point basically agree that climate change is happening. The question is, to what extent are humans responsible, and what can we do or what should we do? And so to that, the issue is these things are happening regardless of whether you believe in them or not. And the question then becomes, who's responsible for addressing this issue, and what is fair as far as developed countries versus developing countries? So it's fine to debate the science. Science requires that kind of a conversation. But once we understand that we have come to an agreement about some of the contours of what science is saying, and the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change is pretty unequivocal on that matter, that climate change is happening and that humans are causing it, the question then becomes, what can we do at the country level? What can we do at the international level to address this problem?
549-2937, Susan in Mandarin. Hi, Susan. Good morning.
Good morning. My question is, there's going to be something on the ballot in Florida called Solar Choice, and I was wondering if your speaker thinks that that amendment will help with innovation in making solar a more viable choice to cut down on the use of fossil fuels. Thank you.
Thank you, Susan.
Sure, and thank you very much for your question. I was attending a talk put on by the U.S. Green Building Council in North Florida a couple weeks ago. And what's really fascinating about the referendum measure that you're talking about solar choice, is that it's bringing together environmentalists and Tea Party activists. because it's about freedom. It's about the ability to choose how you want your energy to be produced. And if people do have that degree of freedom and they're able to select more renewable energy options, then I believe that that will have a positive impact on reducing emissions in the United States, and particularly Florida.
549-2937 to join the show with your thoughts and questions about the upcoming Paris climate talks. They are proceeding, but in a much reduced capacity after the attacks in Paris Friday night. Dave is in Nassau County. Hello, Dave. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. How are you?
Good, thank you.
That's good. I was actually kind of surprised that you, Melissa, made the suggestion that there is a comparison between climate change as an existential threat versus terrorism as an existential threat. I mean, from the standpoint of sheer numbers, more people have been killed, more Americans have been killed by police officers than have been killed by terrorists. So the suggestion that terrorism could be even approaching an existential threat to the United States or any other nation is preposterous. And I find it really disturbing that we know we've got a problem with climate change. We know that there is a problem, and I'm quite certain that during the course of this program, you'll probably have some right-wing person who calls in and insists that there's no such thing as climate change. But the science is there. The threat is there. It's a global threat, and terrorism shouldn't even show up on the spectrum as in terms of threats that we're facing.
Dave, thanks for the call. And I think it's important to note that when people talk about existential threats, different people define existential differently. but what about his point? Because some people see the news, they see people getting shot up in a world capital, and they become very afraid. Other people, like Dave, look at the data and look at the odds of something like that happening in their American city and think, well, that the odds of that happening in my town are probably pretty low. What do you think about what he said?
Well, I think that we have to consider, you know, if you're talking about the foreign policy establishment, the federal government, the security apparatus, they have to consider anything that could be considered a threat to the American people. And threats come from very different corners of the world, and they may be more existential or less existential. I don't think that diminishes the importance of either, really, in the discussion. And it's, again, it's not an either-or proposition. We can focus on making Americans safe, addressing terrorism, and addressing climate change in the Paris talks. Neither of these are mutually exclusive.
549-2937, Marie on the South Side. Hi, Marie.
Yes, hello?
Go ahead.
Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, am I on the air?
Yes.
Oh my gosh! Okay, I'm sorry. Okay, my personal opinion is the environment around the world, things that are negatively affecting it, like people's ability to have clean water, clean air. The United States is, you know, one of our corporations destroy a lot of places around the world, and I think this breeds terrorism. That's my personal opinion. You know, it started with the war in Iraq. I mean, we've destroyed this birthplace of civilization. I don't know. I hope I'm wrong, but that's how I feel. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for that. And now it's another Maria, actually, in Putnam County. Maria, good morning to you.
Good morning. Good morning. A great issue to bring up right now. I'm the artist rendition of, you know, I'm a little out there, but my ideas about what's really going on, I just say them anyway, you know that. The comment the man made about cops are shooting up more people, blah, blah, blah. Well, if we want to get really logistic about it, let's say that more people die from legally prescribed pharmaceuticals in this country than all of illegal drugs combined. But all that's really beside the point. If somebody wants to rule the world and you're in a vehicle, they're going to destroy your vehicle. So we should be asking ourselves, who wants to rule the world, or who has all the money? Who has control of all the money? And why would they care if they destroy the planet and get in the way of EPA and tie hands and seems to have some kind of chess moves going on in our own government system, not to mention Saudi Arabia's capital sits right next door to our Saudi Arabia's embassy sits right next door to our capital. And I don't know, you know, every time I turn around, some bank that's opened up is owned by Saudi Arabia. I mean, I'm not an expert, but I'm not an idiot. I was on the phone with Captain William B. Corson III, who was a captain on an oil boat in the Gulf for 30 years. He's saying, Tina, there's no reason for a rig to blow in this Gulf. There's too many safety precautions in place. We evacuate all the men but 11, and then we wait for the CEO to give the shutdown order. And he would not give the shutdown order.
But Maria, what's your what's the point?
Who was holding the gun to BP's head, saying you're not gonna evacuate that rig and shut it down? You're gonna let it blow. In other words, I don't think that was an accident.
Okay. Thanks for the call. All right, let's move along. Norma, go ahead, Norma.
Hi, I just wanted to. I for one, I'm a believer. And good morning, first of all. I, for one, am a believer of that there is climate change and that a lot of it is caused by us humans. And so my question is, and it's really not a question, more of a pondering. Let's assume our elected officials do not believe that there is climate change and they take the position that we don't need to do anything. What is the harm of just trying to improve the climate? There is no downside to it. If it doesn't help, it doesn't help, but it certainly it's not going to hurt any to try. And I just don't know how we can convey that to our elected officials that there is nothing wrong with trying to improve the climate or make it better so our generations to come enjoy what we've had so far.
Thanks, Norma. How hopeful are you, Josh, that these talks will actually accomplish something?
Well, years ago, I sat in a room not much larger than this and talked to my professors who asked me whether there was going to be a deal on climate change. And I was pretty pessimistic at the time. My response was, I think we're going to see individual countries doing their own things and regions like in the United States. California has been a leader in that regard. And in the past 2 years, I've had to completely do an about-face because I've seen so many promising developments on the front of climate change in advance of this really important set of talks that I now have. I'm much more optimistic that countries will be able to work together to, you know, find a solution that is equitable and that addresses the fundamental nature of emissions.
Let's hope so. Let's keep following it. We couldn't get to every single call and tweet. Lots of engagement, though, and we appreciate it. UNF's Josh Gellers, thanks for being with us.
Thanks very much.
Much more still ahead later, how local charities are taking advantage of hashtag Giving Tuesday, a new social media movement kicking off soon. But up next, our book club looks at the great films of 1939. So many did start out as books. We want to hear your favorites right after this.
Sweeping changes could be in store for Duval Public Schools, including school zone boundary shifts, school uniforms, and underperforming schools being converted into special academies. WJCT's Community Thread invites you to tune in for a conversation hosted by Melissa Ross with Duval County Superintendent Nikolai Vitti and community stakeholders about the direction of our schools. Community Thread, Thursday night at 8 on WJCT Public Television.
WJCT, the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville, and Grassroots Natural Market are accepting submissions from local artists for The Square. The Square is an online venue where artists share their work with the community and compete for a chance to be featured on WJCT-TV and radio. Submit now through November 30th. To learn more about The Square and to submit your work, Visit wjct.org/thesquare.
On the next Fresh Air, our postponed interview with the star and the director of the new film Brooklyn, which is based on the best-selling novel by Colm Tobin. Also, novelist David Mitchell, who's best known for his book Cloud Atlas, talks about his new novel, his stammer, and how translating a book about autism helped him understand his autistic son. Join us weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
This is the sound of drama. This is the sound of your community.
Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.
Stay connected. Stay informed. Enjoy live streaming of your favorite local WJCT and PBS and NPR content, all free from your devices. The WJCT app, available now in the Apple App Store and Google Play.
Welcome back. Well, it's a real chicken or egg question. Which is better, the book or the movie? Our book club blogger Stacey Goldring and our own in-house movie lover David Luckin have been trying to decide. Right now they're going to discuss their favorite blicks, books made into movies, right here on the show. In particular, they're going to look at a great year in filmmaking, 1939. That was a year when Hollywood turned out some of the greatest movies ever made. Stacey, David, good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning. Nice to be here.
Good morning,
Melissa. Hey, David, how are you?
I'm good.
And great. Wow, what a year that was. What was going on in 1939? Because they were just at the top of their
cranking
game.
Cranking them out. David, you have some numbers on how many films were made.
365 films were released in 1935. Moviegoers were buying tickets at the rate of 80 million a week.
Can you imagine?
365 films. They were a movie every day.
Uh-huh. Every day. And they were some of the greatest films ever made. And we must say, Stacey and I were talking earlier about air conditioning and heat.
Yes.
Because a lot of people found their air conditioning in those hot cities in the theaters, or they found their heat in the winter. By
and
just
they could sit
hanging.
There all day long.
They didn't kick you out in the old days, Melissa. You buy one ticket, you could
you
watch the movie.
You were around then, weren't you? No, I'm just kidding.
You were
now,
in.
Now, let's look at the list. Gone with the Wind, The Wizard of Oz, Wuthering Heights, Ninotchka, Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, The Hunchback of Notre Dame, Stagecoach, The Women, Goodbye, Mr. Chips, and on and on and on. Of Mice and Men, mm-hmm. many, many movies that started, of course, as books.
Absolutely, and that's where we get the evolution of blicks. And what's amazing is that sometimes when you have a book that is made into a film, the book gets subsumed or it gets eclipsed by the book, and that is exactly what happened with Gone with the Wind. Once the movie came out, any literary merit that the book could have was completely, you know, kind of put on mute because the movie became so important as a part of popular culture. But literarily speaking, the book has the film has so much merit in and of itself. In fact, don't you have a clip?
Yes, because in the book Gone with the Wind, mm-hmm. Rhett Butler never said a very famous line. But in the movie, of course, mm-hmm. it's one of the most famous lines in movie history.
That's right.
Let's take a listen.
Rhett, you go. Where shall I go? What shall I do?
Frankly, my dear, I don't give a damn.
And isn't it right, David, that the censors didn't want to let him say that?
They didn't.
They were very uncomfortable with that.
But they did anyway.
But they let it go through.
There were a lot worse words.
Right. But Margaret Mitchell never wrote those words.
Well, frankly, there was no frankly.
She said, my dear, I don't give a damn.
Yeah, no frankly.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They put just left. Yeah.
Did he ad-lib that? Did Clark Gable ad-lib
it? I don't know if he
ad-lib
it, but
that?
It definitely has great alliteration, so perhaps. But in the book also, Scarlett, she ain't pretty. The first line, the book, this is how it describes Scarlett. She ain't no Vivian Leigh. Not beautiful, but men seldom realized it. Unquote. So right away, we know we are dealing with someone who's going to go against the grain. This is a woman who was a tomboy, and she didn't like to dress up, and she was hungry, and she was never supposed to have an appetite, and she was never supposed to act like a tomboy. She was supposed to snag a husband. that, you know, that was, you know, that was her job. That was her one job.
But they couldn't have an unattractive heroine in the movie. Well, that wouldn't have worked.
Well, I didn't, you know, I wasn't involved in the directorship, and evidently they went through three directors?
Three directors, yeah. But they didn't pick Marie Dressler, okay? They picked Vivian Leigh.
But everybody auditioned for the part of Scarlett. Oh, many, every actress in Hollywood.
And you can see those clips. YouTube probably has them. I've seen them. So many people audition.
It's kind of funny to look at them and envision someone else playing her, because it's hard to imagine anyone else.
She's in your
but
head.
Vivian Leigh playing her.
Well, when that book came out, it was an immediate bestseller. Absolutely. Think about it. Americans were living through the Great Depression, okay? So they could truly identify with Scarlett's trials. Here's someone who has suffered through the war. She is going to bounce back. She epitomizes the Old South turning into the New South. They will rise again. But also, she's America. She is going to make it happen. She will, you know, we start off, and remember how we have the scene where she's trying to get in that corset and she's not supposed to be hungry and blah, blah, blah. And then part two or three or six, however long the movie goes on and the book goes on, she swears she will never go hungry again. So the whole idea of famine, and really, if you want to think about it, this is a fabulous book about feminism. Who's really in charge of Tara? It's not Gerald. It's Ellen O'Hara. That's the woman in charge. When Scarlett comes home and, you know, the house is burnt out, and I'm not giving it away, and her father keeps referring to the fact that, you know, we'll have Miss Ellen will decide that. Mrs. O'Hara will take care of that. So really, you can look through it through a feminist lens. Did they do that when it came out in 39, though, David? I don't know.
Well, he lost his mind. In the movie, he loses his mind.
Because he thinks that the South has, you know, lost, but not in the book.
Yeah.
In the book, Sue Ellen tricks him into signing an oath.
Now we're talking about Dallas.
Oh, no, no. Sue Ellen.
And
Sue Ellen, the sister. Tricks him into signing an oath to the union. And he's, you know, drunk off his rocker. And when he wakes up and realizes, wait a minute, I don't want to sign that, then he gets on his horse, jumps, breaks his neck. And
now let's talk about some other Blicks, in particular Of Mice and Men.
I watched it last night. What a stark,
brutal,
hard movie.
Just like the book.
No humor in that film at all. And brilliantly acted from the original. Five of the main stars came right off the stage of New York to recreate it.
And truly from the mind of John Steinbeck, because he wrote it as a novella, only six chapters, but he was thinking screenplay the whole time. And this is why we have the character of Lenny, who George has to explain everything to, because that is a great literary tool to use to explain things to your readers of what the backstory, or explain to your audience sitting, you know, watching you on the stage. So really, this one, unlike Gone with the Wind, Of Mice and Men, David, wouldn't you agree that it's just like the book?
It is. It is. And it's just like the play. And it plays out like a play, because there's just only three or four or five sets in the whole film. And we've got a little clip of one of the heartbreaking scenes of this film.
Okay, everyone get a Kleenex. Get a tissue. It's brutal.
This old fella just suffers himself all the time. Now, if you was to take him out and shoot him, right in the back of the head, right there. Why, he'd never know what hit him. So he won't shoot him.
No, I couldn't do that. I had him too long.
But he don't have no fun no more. Besides, he smells bad. Tell you what I'll do. I'll shoot him for you, then it won't be you that done it.
Oh, let him alone, Carl. It ain't a guy's dog that matters. It's the way a guy feels about his dog.
Wow.
It's right out of the book, man. I mean, it is so brutal.
Now, what are some other ones that stick out to you?
Well, do you watch House of Cards?
I love House of Cards.
Okay, you know, House of Cards nods to this scene in the book and in the movie, because in House of Cards, if you remember, Kevin Spacey does a nasty on a dog.
In the first episode.
And we never see it. but we only hear it.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how it is portrayed in the film, yeah? Are there any pictures of the dogs being shot?
No. I mean, and they make you wait so long in the film. They're all just trying to play cards, and what is taking them? Because everyone is just broken.
And, you know, the whole movie is we have a great plan. We're going to live on a farm. We're going to raise rabbits. It's going to be great, George. It's going to be, Lenny, it's going to be great. And then the title of the film, the title of the book, thank goodness they didn't change it, comes from a Robert Burns poem. The best laid schemes of mice and men often go astray.
Mm-hmm.
It just breaks your heart. So good.
It is. And it's incredible how right up into the present day, Hollywood always takes great books and mines them for source material. And
always.
Turns them into movies. And
we go back to Shakespeare, Romeo and Juliet, right. Shakespeare in Love. I mean, that year, though, Dave, in 1939, The Rains That Came, The Women, Claire Luke Booth, The Love Affair.
The Wizard of Oz.
Which the book is actually called The Wonderful Wizard of Oz.
Of course you would know
and
that.
And P.S., no ruby slippers in the book. Silver shoes. They're silver. You know why they switched? Because silver shoes would not show up nicely on the screen with the gold, the yellow brick road.
You need primary colors.
Yes, we remember our color wheel, and so you got to go to the red. So that is why.
She is brilliant. Our book club blogger, Stacey Goldering, and our own David Luckin. Sharing their movie knowledge today.
Thank you so much, David. Just a few bits of what's coming up.
Really quickly.
Okay, just go ahead and WJCT, go to books at WJCT.org, and we'll let you know what's coming up for Blix in December.
That's right, more coming next month. And in a moment, how you can take part in Giving Tuesday, the social media movement that kicks off the season of giving.
Better safe than sorry, right? Yeah, maybe not.
There's no doubt that oftentimes when we're trying to make ourselves safer, we're actually doing things that may make us take more different risks and end up having different types of disasters.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, the hidden dangers of being safe. That is next time on Marketplace from APM.
Weeknights at 6 on 89.9 WJCT, community-supported public radio.
WJCT and the Florida Theater are proud to present Michael Feldman's What Do You Know Live. That's right, I'm bringing my show to Jacksonville on February 20th. We'll do the quiz, have some fun, enjoy a little bit of a break from the Wisconsin winter. So, do your holiday shopping earlier, surprise your Valentine next February. Tickets available now at the Florida Theater box office by phone at 904-355-2787 or online at floridatheater.com.
NPR News continues covering the story out of Paris as details of the attacks become clearer and the manhunt for those involved continues. Our colleague Robert Siegel is with our team in Paris, bringing us the voices and sounds of the French capital as it mourns and as the world responds. That's later on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Welcome back. Well, it's an almost daily dilemma for leaders in any organization. They have to make decisions without complete information. And often those decisions are complex and risky. Former senior executive and transportation engineer Shelley Rowe has some advice for those leaders. Don't overthink it. It's a process she calls infotuition. Rowe is speaking about this today at a talk on the UNF campus. She gave me a preview. Take a listen.
Shelley Rowe, welcome to the program. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
It's exciting to have you come and speak here in our area. I want to ask you about a buzzword that I know you'll be speaking about, infotuition. That caught my attention. What is infotuition?
Well, I'm glad you asked. It means the balance of cognition and intuition in a decision-making situation. So, for example, Melissa, if you're faced with a really tough decision, a lot of issues, a lot of complexity around it, then sometimes we overthink it, or we get stuck, or maybe we have a knee-jerk reaction. So there's no word that I could find that meant that just right balance between cognition and intuition. So I made one up. I call it infotuition. And for me, it's really become a skill set on how to get that just right balance so that you make the right decision the first time.
Because ultimately, you can only have so much data. At the end, you have to make a decision that involves a leap of faith so often in business. Is that right?
That's true. And I did interviews with 77 executives because I knew how much that intuitive voice meant to me in my career, but I thought maybe it was just me. So I interviewed, like I said, 77 executives, and what I found is that they believe that intuitive voice, that gut feel, is an essential part of their leadership success. And then I began to study how does that work, and that's where the neuroscience has become so important, and it enables us to understand kind of what's going on in the brain when you're making that insightful decision and everything just seems to come together just right.
What are some examples you could point to that people might recognize that they've even maybe read about in the news, and particularly in your field of transportation?
Oh, that's an interesting question. What I find that, particularly with the people that I interviewed, if they're trying to work with, say, a state legislature or a city council in making a difficult choice about a transportation investment, a lot of times the numbers tell you part of the story. But a lot of it goes into how do people feel about that particular transportation improvement? How is it important to their life? Do they see it as an asset? Do they see it not as an asset? And understanding those dynamics are a big part of that ultimate decision. And you don't have numbers around that. So it's a matter of being self-aware enough to know that you have to get the numbers, you need to get a lot of input, and then let it kind of percolate a little bit, kind of mush together a bit, and come to the decision that, yeah, it makes sense, but it also is the one that feels right.
Do you find that female executives are more likely to trust their gut than male executives, or is there no gender difference?
In my research, again, in those interviews, and of course it's very subjective, of the 77 executives that I interviewed, about two-thirds of them were men. And I was not able to discern a difference between the men and the women that I interviewed. What I did discover is that those like me, who I'm an engineer by training, and I've been in the engineering field for my whole career. So those who were trained as engineers, lawyers, people in the financial industry, tended to naturally be very cognitive. And that didn't matter whether they were men or women. But as they moved into leadership positions, that they learned to be more intuitive. They learned to trust their gut more and with more experience. And that was true across the board, whether it was men or women. So in that sense, I was unable to hear a difference between men and women leaders. However, there was some feeling, and perhaps maybe a trend, but if so, a slight one, that the women were perhaps a bit more quick to trust that gut feel than some of the men, who would kind of fight it.
Why do you think that is?
I think because, and I find it in myself, I'm actually more on that side, I'm very much on the overthinking side. I think it's because we've been trained to be very logical and rational. Our culture supports and validates the logic, the systematic thinking, step-by-step kind of problem-solving approach. We want it to always be logical. So there's a very strong inclination to want everything to be methodical and rational. And it's a big shift to have to recognize that it just doesn't work that way. And the more difficult the decision, the less likely it is to work that way. And it's a big shift in mental attitude to be receptive to a different way to approach problem solving.
Hmm. Well, something else you'll be getting into, the future of transit and disruptive technology that's really creating an upheaval in transportation, everything from self-driving cars to information at our fingertips via apps on our smartphones that make it easier for us to travel. What are some trends we can hear from you when it comes to transit?
And it's really about the broader issue of transportation. I believe that we are in a period of disruption in the transportation field. And all of us are experiencing that. Those of us who are transportation professionals, it's really a big shift for us. And I see it as a combination of several different factors. One is the technology factors, like we see with self-driving vehicles. We'll also be talking about connected vehicles, which is a little bit different. So you have the technology trends in vehicles. You have technology trends that we see like in cell phones and apps, the mobile environment, being able to connect with each other through a wide array of media, like social media. So you've got all those technology trends. And then you also have social trends, like the trend toward the sharing economy. We're seeing very different value systems for millennials who are less inclined to want to drive a car and more inclined to just have transportation be a service that they need. For me, the disruption, I believe, comes when you begin to link all those trends together, and it looks like it's a real fundamental shift in the way that transportation will be happening in the relatively near future.
It will be fascinating to watch it change. In the meantime, this just gives us a short window into your talk coming up on the UNF campus. Shelley Rowe, a pleasure, and thanks for being with us.
It is my pleasure, and I look forward to being in Jacksonville.
That's Shelley Rowe speaking today at noon at UNF, the event sponsored by Women in Transportation. And finally this hour, it's the day that kicks off the season of giving, Giving Tuesday. Now in its fourth year, hashtag Giving Tuesday is a global day of giving fueled by the power of social media. On Tuesday, December 1st, charities, families, businesses, students worldwide come together for one purpose, to give. Here in our area, Catholic Charities joined the movement last year and raised support for putting compassion into action. Ruth Ann Hepler is Director of Development with Catholic Charities here in Jacksonville, and she joins us with more. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa.
So Giving Tuesday has really taken off. How did Catholic Charities harness the power of this?
Well, we had a fantastic Giving Tuesday last year. We had more than $2,000 in donations come in on that day, and we are working even harder this year to promote it on social media. Which has been really big for us. And so we're just reaching out with all of our channels, constant contact, but mostly social media, to remind people to use that day as a day to remember to give back to those less fortunate after they do their Black Friday shopping and their Small Business Saturday and then their Cyber Monday. They use that following Tuesday after Thanksgiving to put compassion into action and think about the less fortunate.
That's right. It's the Tuesday after Thanksgiving, Tuesday, December 1st, hashtag Giving Tuesday. You can find that on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, any social media platform that you go to. So when people go to any social media platform, any charity they wish to donate to, they will see people asking for appeals. How did Catholic Charities use the campaign to raise funds? Can you tell us what tactics you used?
Well, like I said, we really utilize mostly Facebook, other social media channels as well, but mostly Facebook, and we use Facebook to highlight the different programs that we have and how we actually help people. We like to, you know, use the photos and things like that to show people examples of what we're actually doing. So they say, "What if I'm giving to Catholic Charities, what is my money going to?" You can look on our Facebook page and see, you know, what we're actually doing to help real people, real neighbors in need right here in Jacksonville.
So. And Catholic Charities helps families in need across the city, whether they're Catholic or not. You just help families in need.
Right. Actually, the vast majority of people we help are not Catholic. We don't discriminate in any way. We don't proselytize. We just help people in need. That's what we think we're called to do. And so we help, like you said, families who are in crisis. We have a variety of other programs as well. As you know, our Camp I'm Special down in Marywood, and a variety of other things that we do to help people in crisis.
And small donations add up, too. When people look for this hashtag on December 1st, hashtag Giving Tuesday,
people are encouraged to give whatever they can afford to give to whatever nonprofit they believe in, right?
Absolutely. There are more than 1,000 nonprofits in Jacksonville, and they're all doing great work. Of course, we'd love to have people give to Catholic Charities, but no amount is too small, and those $5 contributions, those $10 contributions really do add up. And it's whatever you feel that you can give, even a little bit, is going to help somebody who's less fortunate than you are. So
exactly. And at this time of year, families that are struggling, a small amount can mean a holiday meal, an extra toy for a child that might not otherwise have one. A small amount makes such a big difference.
It does. And, you know, being in the nonprofit world, we take those donations and really leverage them to make the dollar go a lot farther than you could take your dollar to the grocery store. We can really stretch that through all of our channels to make it go a long way.
That's right. So mark your calendar for Tuesday, December 1st, or just remember the Tuesday after Thanksgiving is Giving Tuesday. It's a global movement powered by social media. Look for the hashtag Giving Tuesday next Tuesday, December 1st. And as Ruth Ann said, Catholic Charities will be promoting it heavily. Of course, lots of nonprofits will. Visit their website at ccbjacks.org and learn more about their mission. And make sure to be generous on Giving Tuesday and throughout the holiday season. Ruth Ann Hepler, Director of Development with Catholic Charities of Jacksonville. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks, Melissa, and happy Thanksgiving.
You too. And that's our program. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Sean Birch. The show theme, composed and performed by the Symphony's Pyotr Chevchik. Never miss a program. Subscribe to our daily podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Next on Diane Rehm, new pressures on the Obama administration and Europe to rethink strategies in the fight against ISIS. How the deadly attacks in Paris ratchet up the debate over security, electronic surveillance, and coordinated military action in Syria. That's next. I'm Melissa Ross, and you're listening to First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT FM Jacksonville. Your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.